This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. The Jewish son of a rabbi in Appleton, Wisconsin, Eric Weiss, transformed himself into the world's most famous magician, escape artist, and debunker of fake mediums, Harry Houdini. Now Houdini's story is retold in a comprehensive and well-researched new biography, The Secret Life of Houdini, The Making of America's First Superhero, by William Kalush and Larry Sloman, who join us tonight. Gentlemen, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi. Hi, Gary.
Now, Larry Sloman, you've written many books on American history and popular culture, including books on Abbie Hoffman and Bob Dylan, and I want to talk to you about all that later. And William Kalush, you're an expert on illusionists and the founder of ConjuringArts.org, which I also want to know some more about. But tell us how you two came together to write this book.
Well, we have a mutual friend named David Blaine, who I've known David for years and years, even before he was on television. And once he became a celebrity, he wanted Larry to help him write a book, and I helped with the research on that, and we've been friends ever since.
Basically, what happened was we did a chapter on Houdini in the Blaine book, and that was my first exposure to the whole Houdini literature, and I read every book written about Houdini. And as I was doing that, I kept on saying to Bill, you know, there's things that just don't compute, and he does weird things at weird times, and I think there may be, we both agree that we think there may be a whole hidden kind of secret part aspect to his life, and the more we dug into it, the more we found it.
Now, is this because, Larry Sloman, you're a conspiracy theorist, you see conspiracies behind everything?
No, I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
I'm
friends with conspiracy theorists, but some of my best friends.
Mine too. Now, you mentioned some of the previous books, and there was one not very long ago, a rather exhaustive biography of Houdini. So what can you talk a little bit about what the previous books didn't tell?
Well, there's kind of two levels to that question. One is, of course, we found the evidence of him working for Scotland Yard and the circumstantial evidence of him helping the U.S. Secret Service with some espionage. And we also found a huge amount of new information about various moments in his life and the end of his life when he's involved fighting fraudulent spiritualists. But we also didn't feel that the other important biographies had really represented who Houdini was as a person in the sense of how did he become so famous? Why did it work for him and none of his imitators or anybody else from that period or any period since? And that's something we've addressed in that book.
You say in the book that even today, if you ask people to name a magician, Houdini is the first one that comes to the mind of 90% of the people you ask.
Well, not just people, but we purposely went after young people that couldn't possibly know anything about him firsthand or even maybe thirdhand. So we were trying to make the case and the point that he's really part of our culture.
Well, let's trace his history a little bit. How did Houdini how did he come to be? Was he rocketed to Earth from the dying planet Krypton?
Well, kind of. He was sent out of a difficult position in Budapest. His father had been a soap maker when he started out and ended up going to law school and becoming a lawyer in Budapest. And something happened that nobody knows what it was that propelled him to America without a job. There wasn't any call for Hungarian lawyers. And when he ended up in Appleton, Wisconsin, the town father, who was a kind of a friend of the family, so to speak, that's how they ended up there, said, well, we have a lot of Jewish families, but we don't have a rabbi. And Houdini's father said, well, that's me. And this is Houdini had been born in Budapest, but then came over as a young boy, and this kind of struggle, he wasn't a successful rabbi, Houdini's father, so this sort of struggle is what he was born from. and he got interested in magic, and he took the name of the great, he took part of the name of the great Robert Houdin, believing that adding an I would make him like Houdin, and he became Houdini. And he just started working as hard as he possibly could. And then he discovered an important secret that really created the Superman.
Well, before you tell me what that secret was, he originally had his brother working in his act with him?
He originally worked with a young man that worked with him at a necktie cutting factory named Hyman. But when that didn't work out, then he brought his younger brother Dash in.
Mm-hmm. Of course, he kicked his brother out when he met his then soon to be wife, Bess.
His wife, and she replaced him in the act.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, so for years, Houdini toiled in dime museums, and then he suddenly became an overnight sensation. How did that happen? What was his secret?
Well, it's sort of twofold. He had stumbled onto the idea. He was doing magic more or less like a normal period magician at the time. And he stumbled into the idea that in one of his routines he had his hands bound behind his back, and behind his back for his metamorphosis, and he realized that if he allowed them to bring their own handcuffs instead of tying them up, that was kind of interesting. And then he realized they didn't have handcuffs, normal people. So then he challenged the police to. He'd go to the police stations and challenge them with their handcuffs, and he toiled with that too. And then he met a man named Andrew Rohan, a really important police officer in Chicago. And Rohan took a liking to him, and sure enough, the next day, Houdini's picture for the very first time was on the front page of the newspaper. And that was a turning point for him.
So challenging the cops was his, that was the thing.
Right. Challenging the police with escapes. And it would eventually, over time, within 5 or 6 years, the concept of challenge, the whole idea that he could defeat anything that's coming, no matter what it was, he'll beat the challenge. He won't just escape from his own devices. That's really what created the mythos of the Superman who could escape from anything, and that's who he was.
Now, as a historian of illusionists, how common were magicians at the time of Houdini in vaudeville or dime museums or whatever?
Lots and lots of magicians, because there were so many different types of venues. The vaudeville was the top. Dime museums, beer gardens, sideshows, circuses. These were closer to the bottom, and there were thousands of magicians from all over the world.
And how far back in history do you go to find magicians?
Oh, well, the earliest document of a performing magician doing magical effects, we're not talking about religion or you know, supernatural magic, mm-hmm. is about 5,000 years ago in Egypt.
Wow.
So, and there's been a continuing sort of tradition ever since.
And now, Mr. Kalush, do you know how Houdini did all of his things?
I'd never say I know how he did all of it, but it's interesting. The last huge biography that was done, which I would say is an excellent book, his kind of closing thesis is Houdini's so famous today because we don't know how he did any of his effects. Well, the truth is, as a magician, we kind of do know how he did most of it. There are certainly a lot of logistical things that are really something that I don't know the logistics of, but we know the actual mechanism of most of it, yes.
Well, I know magicians never reveal and all that, but did he swallow keys and regurgitate them and things of that nature?
Well, it's funny because we don't really gratuitously reveal very much about the secrets in the book,
mm-hmm.
but what we did is where it was necessary, and one of those places was, when I was studying as a kid and was interested in Houdini but didn't know much about him, I always had the feeling that these jail cells were probably some sort of bribery or something. That they, you know, how can that really be real, that a guy can actually get out of actual jail cells?
Yeah.
So we spent two or three pages in the book going through just a massive numbers of the cleverest possible ways that, and he used all those kinds of methods. So he did far cleverer things than just swallowing keys. I mean, he'd hide keys. He'd pat the jailer on the back, and he'd have a key or a pick with a hook on it, and it'd hang on the guy's back while they searched him. And then he'd pat him on the back again and steal it back off. That's just one. I mean, he had shoes where he could move the heels. He'd hide lock picks inside his own locks, and they'd lock him all up, and he'd say, "Well, for the photos, why don't you put some bigger locks and chains? I brought them, and since I'm already locked up, it doesn't really affect the security of anything." So they'd lock him up with more chains and locks, which he provided, and some of those would open up and give him tools.
But apropos giving away secrets, we caught some flack from a very close friend of Bill, who is a very famous and prominent magician, who called and said, after he read the book, and said, "How could you give away the secret of Houdini doing that mind-reading stunt with Teddy Roosevelt?" And we said, "Well, because Houdini wrote about it."
Houdini gave that one away.
I mean, he gave it away. So, but you're right. I mean, there's a lot of proprietary secrets that the magic community doesn't like to come out.
We're chatting tonight with William Kalush and Larry Sloman, and they're the authors of a new book about Houdini called The Secret Life of Houdini, The Making of America's First Superhero. Well, what was Houdini's act like if you were sitting in the audience watching Houdini? Would a lot of it just be Houdini's behind a screen and you're waiting for him to come out, or what happens in his act?
Well, some of the acts were like that. I mean, he did the challenges. I mean, the biggest chunk of his career was escaping from something that somebody else had proffered, had brought to the theater and challenged him to escape from, which, of course, we reveal in the book. For the first time, we not only reveal, but we prove that not only Houdini did these things, but he kind of managed all of it. He thought up the ideas for them to bring to the theater. He encouraged them to challenge him. You know, he limited the scope of what he could be challenged with. But yes, some of them were in full view, and some of them were behind a screen, which is really a great it's great testimony to how powerful a showman he was to get an audience, even then, to sit for an hour or an hour and 15 minutes while he's escaping from something and can't be seen.
You know, probably some of the most spectacular things he did were just promotional things to get people to come to the theater. Like later on in his career, when he did the famous upside-down straitjacket escape while being suspended hundreds of feet in the air, over a major city, and hundreds of thousands of people milling around and watching him do that. I mean, it was a very short thing, but it was unbelievably breathtaking to see that.
And he wasn't making any money doing that because people were just watching.
No. But that was unbelievable publicity. I mean, he was, you know, a lot of people liken him to the P.T. Barnum of the day in terms of his savvy, in publicity.
I was wondering about the picture in the front piece of the book when you first opened the flap there. I was wondering, is that a bunch of people watching Houdini get out of a straitjacket? What's that picture?
You're the first one that's asked that question. We were so happy with that, and we really like it. So you're talking about the end papers,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
And that is precisely, not only is it, we actually turned the photo upside down, it's because it looks better, but it is the audience from Houdini's perspective. And it actually is an audience from his perspective. And what he'd do is he would usually do that upside-down suspended straitjacket from a newspaper building. Being no fool, he knew that guaranteed a lot of coverage in the paper. And, of course, there's cameras in newspaper buildings, so at some point somebody snapped that out of a window from his vantage.
That's a great picture.
Thank you.
Now, Houdini also... I know later in life he was a debunker of spiritualists, but he actually performed as a spiritualist also, didn't he? Kind of a...
Yes, he did. Early on, when he was struggling with his wife, they replicate a lot of the things that phony mediums were doing at that time, and he kind of had a crisis of conscience doing that, and he really stopped even before he went to Europe and got involved on the continent. He really stopped by 1899, stopped doing that. But he certainly knew the techniques of these phony spiritualist mediums, and by knowing that, he was able to be such an effective crusader against them. And he really... you know, we were very privileged to have the access to these unbelievable archives of the medium Marjorie, who at the end of his life was one of his nemesis. And nobody had seen these papers for 80 years, and it really detailed how organized the opposition to him was and how it really was being spearheaded by none other than Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in England.
Hmm. Conan Doyle was spearheading the anti-Houdini...
Doyle was spearheading the whole concept of spiritualism as a religion.
I see.
And Doyle truly believed that he was the Messiah and it was the end of days, and that those that didn't convert to spiritualism would be lost. And what he tried to do is he tried to convert Houdini to spiritualism by having a seance to bring Houdini's beloved mother back. And the motive was, if he had Houdini as a crusader for spiritualism, it would be like having the greatest, you know, public advocate he could possibly get.
Mm-hmm.
And he miscalculated. He didn't convince Houdini, and in fact Houdini went precisely the opposite way, and it created this campaign against fraudulent spiritualists.
Now, Larry, let me pick up on the thing about you said about the crisis of conscience. If you're a magician and you're sawing a woman in half, you're not really sawing her in half, and no one in the audience thinks you're really sawing her in half. They realize that you're doing something, you're playing a trick on them.
Right.
So why was it so wrong to play a trick on them to make them think you were talking to their dead aunt or Uncle Charlie?
Well, because, I mean, these were very vulnerable people. These are people who had, were in the midst of their grief and who would do anything, literally. And in some cases, they, you know, even signed away their whole buildings to these mediums. Houdini never got that kind of graft, but, you know, he did do things where the emotional response of the people in the audience, and in fact, one time they even confronted him backstage and were irate that he could even profess to talk about their dead son. That they're getting messages from their dead son. And he really felt bad that, you know, he was deluding people like that. So, you know, he stopped doing that. And, you know, it was really, that was in 1899. And then, you know, it isn't until the 1920s that he begins this real campaign against the mediums who had, you know, become tremendous. You know, you're talking about organized crime, basically. They shared information from city to city. They had sucker lists. And they were taking in a tremendous amount of money.
And did Houdini actually disguise himself to?
Absolutely. I mean, he organized what he called my own secret service. And he would send advanced scouts in who were showgirls, or he had another woman who worked exclusively for him doing this. They would go and stake out these seances. Ironically enough, I mean, the thing about people that they don't know is they think that Houdini was a skeptic. And in fact, Penn Jillette, when the book came out, he says, "You really disabused me of the notion. I thought Houdini was a great atheist who hated these guys." But he wasn't. Houdini wanted to believe, but he just didn't believe that any of these mediums were really getting in touch with, you know, the other side.
His motivation, in other words, was to find a real one.
That's right.
He was seeking.
Yeah, and he did. He made many compacts with friends of his that they would have, each one would have an individual secret code between Houdini and the other person, and whoever predeceased the other would then try to communicate that. And Houdini even did this with his brother, one of his older brothers, made sure while the brother was on his deathbed, he called him up Saranac Lake, New York, and told the nurse, "Tell him to reveal the code once he dies." And as soon as he died, Houdini went up to his study in his house in Harlem and waited 24 hours, didn't move, for a communication from his brother. Of course, it never came.
Yeah. We're talking with Larry Sloman and William Kalush in their book, biography of Houdini, The Making of America's First Superhero. You know, I think the legend of Houdini has been sort of shrouded in myth, particularly since the Tony Curtis film, which I remember seeing on the NBC Saturday Night at the Movies when I was a kid. And in that film, Houdini had a mother fixation, and he died doing his daring water cabinet trick. It was really great. But your book says these things are untrue.
Well, they are untrue, and they're not even fair. I mean, if you think about this guy who truly, and Gary, he risked his life on a daily basis, and a lot of the things that he did later would kill other people. And to then make a movie about his life and kill him in one of his effects,
yeah.
It's just really, it's passive-aggressive. But the issue about the mother fixation has been a lot cloudier. I mean, everybody who's ever written a book about Houdini understands that the Tony Curtis dying in the water torture cell is just not true. But there is a lot of belief out there, there has been a lot, about him being fixated on his mother. And what we didn't set out to make prove or disprove anything like that, but what we found was that he didn't show any of the symptoms of being a mama's boy or anything, any strange devotion to his mother, just a kind of a normal, loved his mother. He took an oath to his father to always take, on his deathbed, to always take care of her, and he did it. And he made a lot of money, and he sent all of it home to her, and he bought her a big house and always came to visit her. But when she died, he was out of the country, and he reacted to the guilt of not having, even though he'd taken care of her in a kind of monetary sense, he hadn't been around as many days and weeks as he might have been, and that what looks like a mother fixation from her death for about 4 years after or 3 years after was actually a reaction to the guilt he felt.
Now, at the time of her death, was he under the ice, searching for the hole in the ice?
No, he's never under the ice. That wasn't true either.
I love that scene. Poor
the ice, he claimed scene. He did that later, but that was made up. That scene's made up. He was, when she died, he was on his way to Europe, and we got the news. He passed out right on the spot.
Now, your book goes into pretty great detail describing the circumstances of Houdini's death, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that aspect of the story. Was there foul play in his death?
Well, there's certainly very mysterious circumstances surrounding his death. And in fact, I think one could easily make a case for the possibility of foul play. We know that the official cause of death, traumatic appendicitis, is bogus. There's no such thing. You can't rupture your appendix by getting a blow to the stomach. We did find that there was more than one occasion when he was in Montreal right before he died in Detroit that he did get punched, and he got punched by what we think some malevolent people. There's a whole other layer to the story. Houdini had been suffering from what they call ptomaine poisoning a few months before he started on his last tour. He began to act very irrationally. His behavior was erratic. His wife came down with the same kind of ptomaine poisoning. At the time Houdini was admitted to the hospital, Bess has a relapse of this so-called ptomaine poisoning, and she gets into the hospital. While he's in the hospital, he starts recovering, and they give him some kind of an experimental serum, which to this day nobody knows what it is. The records have been sealed. There was never an autopsy done. So there's definitely reason to believe that his death might have been a little more mysterious than the conventional, traumatic appendicitis, which doesn't even exist.
Well, also, there's an important wrinkle there, and that's that we were the first to find we knew who his enemies were, but we were allowed in to really see inside the dark closet of Dr. Crandon, Marjorie's husband, who was a surgeon known as Belly Button Crandon because he had developed some surgeries for appendicitis. And this is a man who we found out would ask to adopt young boys, only boys between the ages of 6 and 9 from England. He'd adopt 2 or 3 if he could at a time. And then they would disappear. And Houdini had found out about this and had put the U.S. Secret Service onto it. And he'd also put a close friend of his, a British MP, onto it. And it was just thereafter that all of a sudden this healthy Superman dies with these strange circumstances.
Well, if we exhumed Houdini's body, does his body exist? Was it cremated? Or
it exists right here in New York, in Queens.
It was embalmed. He's in a very good airtight coffin.
And the doctors that we've talked to about what evidence, seeing that there was no autopsy, what evidence would still be there after 80 years? And one of the toxicologists mentioned to us that if some of this bizarre behavior might be considered mercurial, it might be possible that if they certainly had the motives, if they had access to him, which we don't have evidence of, and they had been giving him bits of mercury, it would account for many of these things, and it would still most likely be in his remains.
Well, would you like to see his body exhumed and an autopsy performed?
I'd like to know the answers. I think an exhumation would be an amazing thing. I think it'd be hard for a lot of us, but I think it would be, I think it would answer a lot of questions. It would be very interesting. I think there's also research to do into the missing young boys that nobody ever got to the bottom of.
The young boys who punched him?
No, young boys that his nemesis.
Dr. Crandon was adopting.
Oh.
The spiritualists had some very, very powerful people behind them. There was another gentleman named de Wyckoff who was the archetype of a robber baron, a multi-millionaire, who was so devoted to Marjorie that we reproduce this letter in the book. While Houdini is on his deathbed, 2 days away from dying, de Wyckoff writes a letter to Crandon that you could read it as a mea culpa, saying, I could not stand by and watch my dear friends blasphemed by this cad Houdini. And, it's circumstantial for sure, but it certainly suggests that we know that people were plotting against Houdini. I mean, he was getting regular death threats. He carried a derringer around. He asked one of his chief female scout who was going to infiltrating the spiritualist movement to carry a gun. There was a lot of evil people around him.
Well, obviously, we've only scratched the surface of your book, which is a gigantically well-researched and interesting book, and it's called The Secret Life of Houdini, The Making of America's First Superhero by William Kalush and Larry Sloman. William Kalush, tell us a little bit about your website, if you would.
Well, we wrote this book here in a nonprofit magic library called the Conjuring Arts Research Center, which is in Midtown Manhattan. The website's conjuringarts.org, and it's supported by donations, which are tax-deductible because it's a nonprofit. And one of the things that we did that's really interesting about our library now because of Houdini is to organize all of our data. We had to invent a new kind of magical search engine, and we've now fed as much as 730,000 pages of magic material, including thousands of Houdini letters, Houdini scrapbooks, this kind of material, and it's all findable and searchable here in the library. So it's a nonprofit magic library in Midtown Manhattan.
Fantastic. And Larry Sloman, what's next for you on your journey of writing all kinds of books about stuff?
I think a little vacation. The Houdini project was grueling, and we had to get it out on the 80th anniversary of his death. So it meant a lot of hard work for 7 months straight, 7 days a week till 4:30 in the morning. So I think I may be going to Disneyland.
Well, I want to thank you both for spending some time with us today.
Well, thank you,
Gary. Thanks,
Gary.
Well, the old clock on the wall says that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I'll be back again next week with another great show. All of the hard work on From the Bookshelf is done by our production staff, Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. Good night, everybody.